Welcome to the NACE Journal Club podcast. We have another great issue for you this month. I'm Dr. Neil Skolnick, professor of family and community medicine at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. Our first article is going to focus on LPA, something you heard about a while ago, and its relationship to elevated cardiovascular risk. But here's the information that's important: whether or not aspirin improves outcome. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. The next article is going to be talking about retatrutide. What is that, you ask? That is a triple hormone receptor agonist for obesity. And this is the results of the phase 2 trial, which is just going to, well, I hope you're seated. It is an impressive trial where we're going to be talking to one of the authors of that trial. Finally, we're going to look at healthy weight loss maintenance after withdrawal of a GLP-1. But what this study looked at is exercise, a GLP-1 receptor agonist alone, or both combined, followed a year later without treatment. And I bet you're wondering what happened, and you will see. Our first article this month is about lipoprotein A, which is something, if you've been listening carefully, you've been hearing some buzz about. The title of the article is Aspirin and Cardiovascular Risk in Individuals with Elevated Lipoprotein A, and it was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Joining us to discuss this article is Dr. Brad Rivotto, who is a resident in the Family Medicine Residency Program at Jefferson Health Abington. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Can you give us some background? Why did they do this study?
I think it's largely being done for two reasons. One is that this lipoprotein A, we know it plays a significant role in both atherogenesis and vascular inflammation. And it was really involved with an increased thrombotic risk. I think it's something we commonly forget about. You know, it doesn't come up on your normal cholesterol panel. Statins don't lower it, and I think we generally forget about it. I know a couple episodes ago, you had Dr. Potter on the podcast to talk about muvalaplin, a drug that's in clinical trials for lowering lipoprotein A, but there's really no other good options for lowering it. I think the other reason is the use of aspirins still a little controversial. Guidelines have changed over the last few years in the role that aspirin will play in cardiovascular disease. And since aspirin has a great antiplatelet effect and lipoprotein A has a thrombotic effect and works on platelets, maybe there's some interaction there in preventing coronary artery disease.
What perfect background. That leads us to the study. What did they look at and how did they look at it?
So the methodology, they used the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis dataset, which is also known as the MESA dataset. This is data collected from 2000 to 2002, ends up with about nearly 7,000 patients initially. And it was an observational study where they used a propensity-matched cohort study to look at aspirin users versus non-aspirin users, and also kind of risk-stratified patients based on lipoprotein A levels into different categories.
And what'd they find?
So the cohort initially contained about 6,600 patients. After the matching of aspirin and non-aspirin users, they ended up with just under 2,200 users. About 1,700 of them had a lipoprotein A level less than 50. About the remaining 400 or so had it greater than lipoprotein A level greater than 50. They broke it down into four categories. There's those with a lipoprotein A greater than 50 without aspirin, and then those with aspirin, and then everyone with a lipoprotein A less than 50 with aspirin and without aspirin. The data was pretty impressive. Those with lipoprotein A level greater than 50 without aspirin had a significant higher rate of cardiovascular disease compared to all other three groups. The elevated lipoprotein A greater than 50 with aspirin ended up with about a 46% reduced risk of coronary artery disease compared to those without aspirin. And their risk was similar to all patients with a lipoprotein A level less than 50.
You know, Brad, that's nothing less than a wow result. I grade results on my own grading scale, and the highest is the wow level. I mean, a decrease of almost 50% in cardiovascular outcomes is impressive. Granted, it's an observational trial. It's not a randomized control trial, but it makes us pay attention. What do you think the implications of this are for clinical practice?
I think especially for our role as family medicine docs, I think one thing we should think about is ordering more lipoprotein A's. It's something that I don't commonly do. Admittedly, I commonly stick to just our normal cholesterol panel and think of our statin therapy. So there might be something I'm missing there. And really thinking about this group of patients that may benefit from aspirin. You know, aspirin over the past few years, guidelines have changed to where there's really a very narrow therapeutic window. You know, after the ASPRE trials, the ARRIVE trials, it's really only patients in a certain age group with high risk disease just due to the bleeding risk. And, you know, maybe there are more patients out there that would benefit simply from adding aspirin to their daily meds.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'll tell you how it's going to change my practice. I heard a couple of years ago that the European Atherosclerosis Society put out a consensus statement that we ought to be checking LPA levels on everyone, all adults, at least once in their life. LDL levels are not levels that change over time for the most part. Now, I heard those recommendations, but I haven't been doing it because for the life of me, I can't figure out what I do with the result. Well, now this changes it. There's some good evidence that it would lead to an action for that patient who might be at elevated cardiovascular risk because maybe they have some hypertension and maybe they have some hyperlipidemia treated with statins, but they still have residual risk even after treatment. This article pretty convincingly suggests that we might be able to substantially decrease that risk by the use of something simple that we've often been on the fence about anyway, just using one baby aspirin a day. So I'm going to think carefully. I don't change on a dime, but I'm going to really think about ordering this more often, and at least for people who seem to be at some elevated risk. Brad, thank you so much for giving such an excellent analysis of this trial.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
For our next article, we're going to be talking about the future. That is, an article from The Lancet on the triple hormone receptor agonist retatrutide for obesity, the results of a phase 2 trial. Joining us to talk about this article is the first author, Julio Rosenstock, who is Senior Scientific Advisor for Velocity Clinical Research, also Director of Velocity Site at Medical City Dallas, and a Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Welcome, Julio.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. Let's talk about this very exciting compound. You know, we're living exciting times in type 2 diabetes, with semaglutide 2 milligrams and 2.4 milligrams having a robust A1C reductions and robust weight loss. Tirzepatide, which is a GIP, GLP-1 receptor agonist, having the A1C reductions of 2% and weight loss of 12 kilograms and so on. But then, and tirzepatide is a dual agonist, GIP and GLP-1 receptor agonist. But now we have a triple G, a GIP, GLP-1 receptor agonist, and glucagon receptor agonist. And that's exactly what we tested in type 2 diabetes.
Now, Julio, for those of us who might not quite remember what glucagon does, except for helping people get out of a hypoglycemic episode, can you tell us what glucagon adds to the picture in this compound?
Well, glucagon, as you said, I mean, glucagon, we regard glucagon as a compound that helps us get out of hypoglycemia, especially in type 1 diabetes, that every single patient with type 1 diabetes should have a glucagon kit or medication to get them out of hypoglycemia, because increases glycolysis, increases hepatic glucose production, and raises the blood glucose. So is counterintuitive to have a compound there for lowering the blood glucose. And actually, it does. It does in combination with GIP and GLP-1. And it has two very important effects. It's lipolytic and also increases energy expenditure. And what the Retatu tried is a single peptide. It's a single peptide with GIP, GLP-1, and glucagon receptor agonist. And what is important is the ratio of GIP, GLP-1, and glucagon. If you give too much of glucagon, then you're going to have hyperglycemia. You just need to have the right amount of glucagon there to really have the effect of increasing energy expenditure and having a lipolytic effect and not having a hyperglycemic effect. Because what this peptide is a once weekly single peptide with agonist activity to the GIP, GLP-1, and glucagon receptors. But the retatrutide is more potent at the GIP receptor and less potent at the glucagon and GLP-1 receptors. So it does have a very impressive results. We tested, this is the first time that, not actually the first time, it's been tested before in a phase two, a multiple ascending dose that was published in The Lancet a few years ago that they show a robust effect on A1C and weight loss. That there was actually published in Lancet last year, but we did a phase 2B study in type 2 diabetes and show very impressive results that we published. We published in Lancet last month in June reported at the ADA.
So can you tell us about that trial, how it was conducted, what it showed?
Well, that was a double-blind, double-dummy study that was done. We have as a comparator dulaglutide, but we tested several dosages of retatrutide. We tested 0.5 milligrams, we tested 4 milligrams, we tested 8 milligrams, and we tested 12 milligrams. And actually, we also tested different ways to titrate. We titrated with 2 milligrams to go to 4, or went straight to 4, or we tested starting with 2 milligrams or 4 milligrams to go up to 8 milligrams. And we went slowly testing every 4 weeks to go to 2, 4, 8, and 12 milligrams. And the results were very impressive in a population that was basically people who have type 2 diabetes on metformin, whose A1C at baseline was 8.3. They were 72% of them were on metformin and have a BMI of 35. So now with that scenario, you can ask me for the results, my dear friend, and I'll tell you the numbers.
Can't wait to hear. Let's hear.
So in terms of fasting reduction, fasting plasma glucose went from a range of 170 to 190. The 8 milligrams and 12 milligrams have 68 milligrams of fasting glucose reduction after 24 and 36 weeks. In the A1C reductions from an 8.3, we had a reduction at 24 weeks of 2%, and at 36 weeks, a reduction of 2.2% in the 12 milligram dose. But actually, the 8 milligrams dose, it gave you a 2.1, 1.9%. So those very robust, nice A1C reductions, pretty much similar to what you get with tirzepatide and semaglutide in general. But the main difference was the body weight loss. But by the way, before that, I can tell you in terms of target A1Cs, Neil, less than 7% was achieved in 80 to 82%. Less than 6.5% was achieved in 79 to 82%. And A1Cs less than 5.7% with the 8 and 12 milligrams was achieved almost at one-third of the patient. So now, one-third of the patient got normal glycemia.
I mean, this is amazing because, Julio, just before we get to the weight, to put this in perspective for our listeners, basal insulin, and you were one of the authors, it's almost 20 years ago, I think, of the Treat-to-Target trial, seeing how good we could do with titrated basal insulin What was the A1C reduction roughly with titrated basal insulin?
Well, I mean, when we got down to 7%, we were extremely happy. I mean, to get that 6.5%, very few will get it. But less than 5.7%, we never even dream about it. I mean, to get less than 5.7%, that means normal glycemia. We cannot get that with the basal insulin alone. I mean, basal insulin plus GLP-1 is a good combination mm-hmm. for people who are on basal insulin and need further advancement of treatment. I will not use prandial insulin. I will use a GLP-1 receptor agonist. But you cannot get to 5.7%.
Yeah. These sort of results are really pretty amazing. But as you said, the really amazing results, share with us the weight loss results.
Well, I mean, when weight loss... You know that the ADA ESD guidelines now put side by side the importance of A1C reduction, which is, I think, a great contribution of the new recommendations, that the weight loss is important, as important or very important side by side with the A1Cs. With the step two trial that was testing semaglutide 2.4 milligrams, you get around 10.6 kilograms weight loss. With the Surpass 2, which is also in people with type 2 diabetes with tirzepatide, you go down to 12.4 kilograms. That's the most that you get in weight loss for people with type 2 diabetes. In general, you can say, Neil, it's very interesting. Whatever you do, whether with the semaglutide or tirzepatide, when you do those compounds in obesity, you get very robust weight loss. But in type 2 diabetes, you get 30% less weight loss with semaglutide or tirzepatide. Well, what you get with triad is 16.8 to 16.9 with 8 to 12 milligrams. So we're talking 17% body weight loss, which is a real wow. Tirzepatide doesn't get there. Semaglutide doesn't get there. And still, this 17% is very impressive for type 2 diabetes. In obese patients, that the data that was also presented at the ADA and published simultaneously in New England Journal of Medicine, the weight loss was 24%. But, you know, 17% in somebody with type 2 diabetes, I'll take it to the bank. For sure, that's a lot, and it's much more than you get with the tirzepatide. Obviously, this is a phase 2 trial, a phase 2B trial over a 36-week trial period. Now there are going to be phase 3 trials, longer attempt to confirm these results. But so far, this compound is the one that has the highest weight loss in type 2 diabetes.
This is pretty amazing. And to remind our listeners that the length of the trial was, 36 weeks, the length of most phase 3 trials that you were mentioning as a comparator ran about 72 weeks. Is that right?
That's right. For a phase 2B trial, I mean, the main result, that was predefined is at 24 weeks, but we extended to 36 weeks. Now, you want to hear something very important also, Neil?
Mm-hmm.
The targets that were attained in terms of body weight loss. You know, for a drug to be approved for obesity indication, you have certain percentage of losing 5% or 10%. Well, 5% was achieved in 91 to 94% of the patients. 5% body weight loss.
Amazing.
71 to 75% of the patients lost 10% of the body weight. 15% body weight was achieved in 58 to 63% of the patients. And that, to put it in perspective, step two, which is semaglutide 2.4 milligrams, 28% achieved body weight loss of 15%. Tirzepatide, which is pretty robust, 15 milligrams, got the 40% of the patients achieved 15% of body weight loss. With retatrutide, around 60% of the people achieved 15% of body weight loss.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. And 20% body weight loss was achieved in 40% of the patients. It's almost getting there like what you get with bariatric surgery. 40% of the patients lost 20% of body weight loss. If you started with 100 kilos, you lost 20 kilos. In pounds, is more than 40-something pounds, 40, 45 pounds. It's amazing. Over 36 weeks.
Yeah, that's astonishing. This really... We have entered a new age of weight management. We truly have, Julio.
Yeah. Very interesting.
It's very exciting, and we'll all look forward to the phase 3 trial. Is it now underway? Have they begun looking at it?
I think so. I think that, you know, when you do this, I got the feeling that these drugs should be used much earlier in the management of type 2 diabetes. Mm. Listen, I mean, if you have somebody newly diagnosed with diabetes or metformin, you put them on this drug, you can actually reverse type 2 diabetes, getting back to normal. I think that we need to change the treatment paradigm in type 2 diabetes. You know me, Neil, I'm a little bit provocative. I think that we just need to revamp those guidelines and be a little bit more proactive. We can reverse type 2 diabetes with these drugs.
Wow, we're going to end on that challenging, provocative statement. Julio, it is always a pleasure talking to you. Dr. Julio Rosenstock, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure is mine, my dear friend.
Great. We've got another great podcast this month with some really fantastic articles. And for our next article, we're going to talk about a article from eClinical Medicine, which is part of the Lancet group of journals, titled Healthy Weight Loss Maintenance with Exercise, GLP-1 Receptor Agonist, or Both, Combined Followed by 1 Year Without Treatment, a Post-Treatment Analysis of a Randomized Placebo-Controlled Trial. That title, I realize, is a little bit confusing, but basically it's saying if you use just a GLP-1 or a GLP-1 along with exercise, once you stop the GLP-1, does it make a difference? Joining us to discuss this article is Imreen Saeed, who is a resident in the Family Medicine Residency Program at Jefferson Health Abington. Imreen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Skolnick.
Imreen, can you tell us about why they did this study in the first place?
Absolutely, Dr. Skolnick. So according to the National Institute for Health, more than 1 in 3 men, 34.1%, and more than 1 in 4 women, 27.5%, are overweight in America. More than 2 in 5 adults, about 42%, have obesity, including severe obesity. And I think that this is very important to address in America. And one of the ways that we are targeting this is weight loss medications. We've seen a rise in people wanting a GLP-1 agonist, and one of the medications, semaglutide, has been seen to allow patients to have a weight loss of 12% over a course of 68 weeks. There's tirzepatide that can increase that weight loss to 18% after 78 weeks because of its dual agonist effects. So as we see an increase in these medications being utilized by us, it's important to see what mechanisms can we give to our patients, what tools can we give in their toolbox so that they can eventually get off of these medications, and what are the ramifications of them stopping this medication.
It's so important, and we're asked that all the time by our patients. So Imreen, how did the authors go about looking at that question?
So this study discusses if weight loss and improved body composition are sustained 1 year after termination of treatment with a GLP-1 agonist, supervised exercise program, or both. It is a randomized controlled triple-blinded trial in Copenhagen conducted at the Department of Biomedical Sciences and Department of Endocrinology at University of Copenhagen. So they took adults with obesity ages 18 to 65 years old with an initial body mass index of 32 to 43. They had to complete an 8-week low-calorie diet to induce a weight loss of at least 5%. Those that were able to do that weight loss were randomly allocated to a group of either liraglutide and their usual physical activity, liraglutide and exercise, placebo and their usual physical activity, and placebo and exercise. They then completed 52 weeks of this treatment and then had no intervention from weeks 52 to 104. So this 1 year post-treatment phase, there was no contact with the participants. And this phase is what we are concentrating on.
And that's so important because we've seen in a number of trials that when you combine exercise, intensive lifestyle modification with the GLP-1, not surprising, you get more weight loss than just the GLP-1 alone. But here, the fascinating thing is what happens when you know, hands off, you're done with the study, and people move forward. Tell us the results.
Absolutely, Neil. This is very fascinating, especially because you allowed these patients to go into their real lives without any interventions. And I think that's an important key element of this. So basically, the results show from randomization to 1 year after terminating of the combined exercise and liraglutide treatment, participants had a reduction of 2.3% of their body weight more than with liraglutide alone. This also led to lowered fat percentage, fat mass, and weight circumference compared to liraglutide alone. The participants who had received the combo treatment maintained a weight loss of at least 10% of their initial body weight compared to others 1 year after the treatment had started. Discontinuation of liraglutide alone was associated with a regain of 70% of fat mass reduction 1 year after the treatment had stopped. This correlates with actually an extension of a study on semaglutide that mentions that 2/3 of the weight loss was regained within the first year after treatment had stopped.
You know, it's fascinating because the worry is always that when we stop a GLP-1, people will regain all their weight. And we know that on the average, people do regain weight. But when we see an individual patient in front of us, our real question is, what is that person going to do? And I think this trial has some important clinical implications. And Maureen, what are your thoughts about those clinical implications?
Absolutely. I think it's important to first think about why are people regaining the weight? And I think there's like a twofold to this, right? The reason for this difference in like giving someone this physical activity with the liraglutide versus just the liraglutide is that the GLP-1 agonist works by being an appetite inhibitor, slowing the gastric emptying, allowing to improved eating habits, reducing uncontrolled and emotional eating, and improving cognitive restraint. When that medication is suddenly stopped, we get appetite inhibition and all of those improved eating behaviors are essentially lost. The participants don't have anything to counter those old habits returning, leading to this rapid weight gain. And I think that's very important to realize since it's so hard to lose weight in the first place. Giving them something to hold on to. Based on this study, 1 year of them essentially being in an exercise program, they were able to use that habit, that good habit that they had come upon, and continue that in this post-treatment phase.
I think it's so important. I mean, this trial really in many ways confirms for me what I've always thought: exercise is a good idea. And it deepens my commitment as a clinician to make sure to advise people correctly and strongly about exercise. We know exercise has a lot of important benefits down the road, separate from its effect on weight. We know that if people who have exercised have less cardiovascular disease, people who have asthma and exercise have less exacerbations, people have less depression, anxiety, etc. We know exercise is good, but the question that has kind of remained for us is, where does it fit in with regard to weight control after use of a GLP-1? And this really is important information as we talk to patients. We need to be talking about the importance of exercise, not just for when you're on the medicine, but that so if you decide to come off the medicine, you'll have a better chance of maintaining that weight control. And Maureen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Skolnick.
So we had a chance to go over some critically important information, some of which we can use later today, and some of which prepares us for tomorrow. Till next month, stay safe.